Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 18, for October 28th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me, as always. This is the 18th edition of the Brainy Gamer Podcast, and I don't do this often enough, so I feel like I ought to remind myself occasionally to thank all of you for listening to the podcast. It means a great deal to me, and the feedback that you send me, the iTunes feedback and email, it's just a wonderful thing. I'm very grateful for it, and I know that a number of you are very loyal listeners who try very hard to make sure not to miss any podcasts, and for that, I'm very grateful, and I hope that I can keep bringing you content that you find enjoyable and interesting about video games. So, this episode of the podcast features my second Gamers Confab, and I'm just thrilled to be able to say that my guests this time are Lee Alexander from Sexy Video Game Land and also Mitch Kerpata from Insult Sword Fighting, two of my favorite game writers out there and just wonderful guests, as you'll see when I get to that segment. A couple of things I just wanted to make note of before the Gamers Confab. As most of you probably know, this is one of the most unbelievable weeks that I can think of since I've been a gamer when it comes to the release of new games. It's just a, you know, it's just a crazy time, a wonderful crazy time if you happen to be a gamer, because right now we've got Fallout 3, it arrived today, and Little Big Planet, same thing, Far Cry 2, and of course Fable 2, which I've been playing for a week, and I can't wait to talk more about and write more about. And hopefully get into some good conversations with people about, because that game is, I think, extraordinarily good. And of course, you know, smaller games like World of Goo and Rock Band 2, which I really have had almost no chance at all to play, except little sessions with my son, who won't stop playing it. So, you know, it's, and I'm leaving out a bunch of games that are coming out that are just sort of quietly emerging during this manna from heaven for gamers. So I hope you're enjoying all this. And I wrote about this on my blog, and I just want to sort of reiterate it here. I don't know if anyone has experienced this in the way that I have, but I found myself recently feeling a certain amount of pressure, particularly as I've played Fable 2, to, you know, kind of get myself through that and finish it, or at least get to some sort of feeling that I've got the game and I understand completely how it works, so that I can drop it and move on to the next big game and keep up with everyone. And I think particularly as a games blogger, you sort of feel this need to be part of the relevant conversation, whatever that conversation of the moment happens to be. And at this particular moment, this very moment, it's mostly been about Far Cry 2, and a lot of my friends are writing about that game and talking about it and twittering about it, and I haven't even started it. And I just keep feeling this sense of, oh my God, that, you know, the train has left the station and I'm not on it and I'm missing everything. But of course, that conversation is dying as we speak, because Fallout 3 is hitting everyone's doorstep, or they're going to the store and picking it up, and now everyone's twittering about that and writing about it, and, you know, that'll have its 5 minutes in the sun, and then I suppose we'll move on to the next thing. For me, that will be Little Big Planet, because I'm just very, very excited about that game. And, you know, what my post was about really, and I don't mean this as a kind of scold, or, you know, I'm issuing instructions to all gamers or some ridiculous thing. Let's slow down a little bit, shall we? Let's take our time, and let's really kind of purposefully and reflectively engage with these games and play them in ways that, you know, kind of honor what the designers have done. Fable 2 in particular, because it really is a kind of a game that does have a beginning and an end, that you It's not like Fallout 3. We could play for hundreds of hours. I mean, you could, but it's obviously not so open-ended. It deserves our attention. It deserves our luxuriating, if you will, in the world and exploring and taking our time and, you know, really in some ways, and I know this may seem a little sentimental, you know, really giving Peter Molyneux and that team of people a reward, and the best reward we can give, which is our time and our attention. And I guess I'm just suggesting, don't blow through that game, and don't blow through Fallout 3, and don't blow through any of these games. Really, you know, take the time to try to enter these worlds, because they're all narrative games, pretty much. And, you know, in certain ways, kind of interrogate the game and confront the game and encounter the things that it has to offer, and do so in ways that allow you to reflect on what's happening and just, you know, play purposefully. And if you do that, I hope that you'll come by the blog or by any blog that's writing about these things and post your comments or write your own piece on your own blog and help us have a conversation that lasts more than a couple of days. And if you decide in 2 weeks, in a month, in 6 months to come back and write about Fable 2, I hope you will. And I hope that if I write about it in 6 months, that you'll come by and read it or listen to me talk about it on the podcast or whatever, and that we don't place these kinds of artificial limits on the lifespan of games. My hope is that as we think about other kinds of media, or literature, that these games have value beyond the two-week period that everyone wants to shine the big bright light on them and then move on to the next big thing. So that's my plea, and I hope that it doesn't come as some kind of, a prescription for how you should play games. And by no means do I want to suggest that somebody who enjoys playing fast and plowing through games quickly, that you're some sort of lesser gamer. I don't mean that in any way. I'm just suggesting that I think there's a fair number of people out there who listen to my podcast who do consider themselves pretty serious gamers, serious in the sense that they care about how games are built and how games communicate meaning and all kinds of things that take time to analyze and understand, and hopefully in the context of a conversation that can evolve over time, these things can emerge in useful ways that, as I said, honor the designers, that give them the due they deserve for the years and years they've spent making these games. So that's my plea, and I appreciate you listening. Now it's time for the Gamers Confab. I hope you enjoy it. We have two topics in the confab, as you'll discover. The first topic is Games of the Month, where I ask my guests to think about the game that's occupied their time the most over the last month, or, you know, the game that got their attention the most, if they found the most interesting. And the second topic is about survival horror. And I'm interested in that genre, particularly as it relates to two recent games, Dead Space and the latest Silent Hill game, and the really significant differences between those games, and questions raised, I think, recently about the nature and the future of the survival horror genre. The two guests that I invited are extraordinarily eloquent about that and have been thinking about it beyond just our chat in the Gamers Confab on their own blogs, and I'll link to those on the site when I release the podcast so that you can read in more detail what both Lee and Mitch have had to say about this particular genre. So that's the Gamers Confab. I hope you enjoy it. Away we go. Okay, we're going to get started, and I'm very happy to welcome Mitch Kropata and Lee Alexander to the Gamers Confab. And the two of you I have a particular debt of gratitude to, because you helped me sort of launch this whole interview thing to begin with. And Mitch was one of my very first guests, and Lee, you came along right after that, and suddenly I had all this credibility as a podcaster. So I'm really grateful for the two of you doing this and being part of the Gamers Confab. Lee is the writer of the Sexy Video Game blog, and she also is the news director at Gamasutra. And she writes for a variety of other online sources, including The Escapist and Paste. And you have a new, sort of a new gig at Variety. Is that right?
I've been with Variety since February, actually. Time goes by really fast. I haven't done much for Paste or The Escapist in a little while, but I still try to keep the Aberrant Gamer up at Gameset Watch. And I do Sexy Video Game Land and Variety mainly right now.
Very cool. And my other guest, Mitch Kropata, is the author of Insult Sword Fighting, great games blog on the net, and also he writes for Boston Phoenix and for Paste. So welcome, Mitch, and welcome, Lee.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I want to begin like I began the first Gamers Confab. We'll see if I can make this kind of a monthly thing. And it's really to just find out from you the game that you've been playing this month that has your attention, the game that may have, I don't know, occupied most of your thinking this month, if there was such a game, and why that game caught your eye. Lee, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. It's funny. I was really excited about a whole bunch of things coming out, and then it turned out that I didn't end up playing any of them. And I mean, it's sort of hard for me to pick a main one right now, but I spent a good deal of time on Silent Hill Homecoming, and I spent a good deal of time on Midnight Club Los Angeles. But my big surprise is that I'm completely hooked on Princess Debut.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I'm completely hooked on Princess Debut right now.
Ah, yes, okay.
It's crazy. I sort of joked on the blog about a week ago that, oh my gosh, I'm so overwhelmed by all these fancy next-gen games, I'm just going to rebel and play Princess Debut. And it turned out that that's exactly what I did, and I got addicted to it. So, you know, you guys can talk about, I don't know, Dead Space or Fable or whatever, but I've been spending like 16 hours every weekend on Princess Debut. So that's my story.
And so what's the hook? What hooked you?
It is actually a hybrid between a rhythm game and a dating sim, which are two of my favorite things. I find it fascinating. I'm actually wondering what it's saying about my social life that I'm spending all this time courting fake princes and trying to get ready for the ball. I mean, there's a lot of little girl fantasy elements in there, but I also think that it's a fun social experiment. I plan to blog about it a lot, but I'm finding myself getting captivated by the dancing the way you do with those reality TV dance shows, and you don't mean to.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hooked on that, and I think it's cute. I think it's clever. I think it's different, and it's my sort of big surprise that I didn't see coming.
I love it. You're a fan of the Harvest Moon series, so you would be like, I would think you'd be a target audience for this game.
Oh, absolutely, exactly. I'm prime field for Princess Debut. I actually spent a good few weeks from September into October just doing nothing but Harvest Moon as well. So that's kind of my sweet spot. So that Princess Debut is really scratching the itch for people who are fans of social games or training and raising, or, you know, the kind of social progress games.
Yeah. Is it the feeling that you have some sort of obligation to the game world and the characters, and, you know, you sort of, they can't do without you. You've got to hang in there and keep going.
Yeah, something like that, definitely. That's a lot of the fun in it for me. But I also think that the game world is really just lighthearted and sweet and, you know, sort of funny. It riffs on a lot of its own conventions, like the magical girl transformation scenes, you know, and the, it makes fun of a lot of, like, of girly anime things. And it has a really cute, sweet world, and it's just fun.
Why do you suppose that, why doesn't anyone want to talk about games like this? Why do we spend so little time? I mean, you know, obviously, I guess you could say the demographics skew towards men and they won't be interested in this game. At least that's what people think. But, I mean, if you think about how little attention games like this get, it's almost impossible for them to make the same kind of dent that other games that might not even be nearly as good would make.
You know, yeah, no, I was thinking about the exact same thing. And indeed, Princess Debut is very pink. I'm still going to recommend it in my next post to readers of my blog, because I think there's a lot of reasons why, you know, thinking kinds of people would get a lot out of it. But I also think it's because these games are not based in action. They're based in emotion and social interaction, which, again, are generally, you know, for better or for worse, associated with female consumers. But they're sort of hard to advertise because you don't have high-end graphics, you don't have explosions, you don't have assassinations and intrigue. Nobody dies, you know, so it's a lot less overt of a message. And then, you know, therefore, I think harder to market and harder for the message to gain traction.
Yeah.
I don't think they are marketing. I've never heard of it before right now.
No, I know they Natsume in general doesn't have a huge marketing push, which, I mean, almost to me, that sort of makes it more fun when I kind of discover a game like this that I'm like, oh my gosh, why is nobody talking about this? I went and I Googled Princess Debut and there's not even a fact for it. And it's a dating sim with a branching plot. It needs a fact.
That kind of interaction is very much what's hooking me into Fable too.
Right.
It's not
exactly
gameplay.
Yeah. It's funny when my friends speak to me about Fable and they're talking about, you know, their progress with this wife or that fiance or, you know, how they're traveling around the different areas and having an impact and, you know, who's reacting to them how. That's a lot of the appeal of a game like Princess Debut as well.
Yeah. How about you, Mitch?
I have still been playing Rock Band 2 almost any chance I get, which is not, you know, it's not a new game. It's been out for a couple of months at this point, but I keep, you know, I've reviewed a few games since then, and every single time I've played them, whether I've liked them or not, I've been sitting there saying, I got to finish this so I can get back to Rock Band 2. It's the only thing I want to play right now.
Do you play it with other people typically or by yourself?
I have mostly been playing it by myself just because of circumstances, but I play it with other people when I can. And it doesn't really work out too well in my apartment because I have it all shoved into a corner and I can't really fit anybody else here. But yeah, I actually was at some friends' houses last night. We had about 12 people over there playing Rock Band 2.
Awesome. Do you play guitar primarily?
I've been playing the drums because I never had the first one.
Okay.
So I never, you know, I had played a lot of Guitar Hero games, so I was pretty good at the guitar already, but I've been trying to learn the drums, and it should be said, not doing such a great job, but that's one of the reasons why I keep coming back to it, is I get a little bit better each time I play.
Yeah, I play with my, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, if you're doing a lot of drum training, do you get that sore ankle? Because I'm finding that repetitive fifth pedal thing to be a problem.
It's something of a problem. The bigger problem I had was, I don't know, I posted a picture of it on my blog.
Oh, I saw that.
Giant bruise on my wrist from just hitting, you know, whichever, I don't know the drumming terminology, but just from riding on this yellow pad, I must have been holding the drumstick wrong, and I got this massive bruise right where the bottom of it was hitting me. The biggest problem I have with the kick pedal is if I forget to use the form with the minimal kind of foot motion and start stomping down on it, that's the bigger problem I have. It starts to kill my quads.
Yeah,
which I need to rip, obviously.
Should alternate to your drumming foot.
Yeah, oh, geez, that would be something, huh?
You have this monster leg by the end of the year, and the other one's still
just normal. Yeah, I'll just one huge leg, and I'll be great at drumming. If that happens, you know, worse things could have probably happened.
I love the drums. I can only abide the drums if I'm playing the drums. If anyone else is playing the drums and I'm doing anything else at all, it drives me bananas.
Yeah.
It's sort of annoying, isn't it? I mean, you're sitting there playing the guitar. It's part of the problem with Rock Band is that when you're playing the drums, you hear the sticks hitting the drum pads. You don't hear the real drum noises. And when you're singing, especially, nobody is really a very good singer. I don't know, maybe you know some good singers, but I certainly don't. So when they're sitting there singing, or especially when I have the microphone, I think, I know I sounded better than this when I was trying this by myself, but here I am in front of a group of people, and it sounds terrible. It doesn't sound like the song at all. When you play the guitar, it really sounds like the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know if you just heard that. I just hit the drumsticks together because I've been playing with them the whole time we've been talking.
You just can't put them down.
Okay, it's right next to me.
Your point about the drum noise is really salient. It bothers me too. Like, I'm totally, when I'm playing the drums and I'm into it, like, I don't notice the noise and I'm having a great time. But when you're the one on the guitar, it's really annoying. And the good thing is that Konami's Rock Revolution drum kit, you still had drum noise, but it was like a deeper sound, so it sounded a bit like you were really hitting the drums.
Right.
Which was about the only good thing I could say about that game or that drum kit. But, I mean, hopefully they'll consider retooling the Rock Band drums so they don't have that plasticine.
They did a little bit for the new kit. It's more rubbery. It's definitely quieter, and it sounds a little bit more like maybe a practice pad would. But it's still, when I was playing it yesterday, I didn't realize how hard people hit them, because I certainly never noticed when I'm playing. It's still, it does
sort
of break
them hard. You do. You get into hitting them hard. Isn't there a third-party peripheral maker who makes like a cushion or a little koozie that you can put on top of the...
There is.
And has anybody tried that?
In addition, you buy the Ion drum kit if you wanted to drop a few hundred dollars, but no, I have not tried that.
How about no?
But you've got to hit them hard. I mean, what's the point? I mean, you got to hit them hard.
You get into the spirit.
Yeah.
If you hit them too hard, you're probably pressing the bounce a little bit. So you may actually be hurting yourself if you do it that way. You may not be able to play it as fast.
Well, that could be my problem.
It says that on the loading screen. I didn't know that before.
Well, that could be my biggest problem. I can't. I can do easy and just a little bit of the next level, but that's pretty much it for me. I'm pretty lousy.
I find I prefer the Rock Band guitar because the buttons are easier to depress than the guitar. I have one of the older Guitar Hero guitars, and I sort of trained up on that one, and I got almost into expert with that guitar. And then I started playing the Rock Band guitar, and I was like 100 times better because you don't have to like put your whole knuckle into it, so it's a lot easier.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier to slide up and down the neck on that one too, because they're all right next to each other at the same level.
Definitely.
So what does it say that neither of you chose any of these, you know, big AAA games as the game that sort of had your attention over the last month? Is it that these, you know, Fable 2, Fallout 3 is coming, I guess, Tuesday, and you know, all of the other stuff that Far Cry, is it because they just kind of came late in the month and you haven't spent much time with them, or did they just sort of not, you know, sort of compel you that much?
Well, I mean, I've played through, since I got Rock Band 2, I've played through Dead Space and through Silent Hill, and we'll talk about those later. But the thing that I find when I play that kind of a game is that it's not all that much fun. I get a lot out of it, but when it's over, I feel sort of drained. You know, I've put a lot in. I've gone into this sort of dark world, and I just want to take it easy when I'm done. When I play Rock Band, I feel exhilarated. You know, I get up from playing it, and I'm ready to do whatever, and that's a feeling I want to keep chasing. You know, so that's why I play this game anyway.
That's really interesting to me, because I'm picking World of Goo for my game, and it's very much for the same reasons. I wonder if there's some kind of crazy phenomenon about those of us who feel some kind of need to sort of stay up and play. I know, Lee, you've written about this recently, about, mm-hmm. you know, how do we possibly keep deriving joy out of this, you know, this train that's just barreling down the tracks and we've got to stay on. I've been writing a piece about that. I think if I can finish it for tomorrow, I hope to. But this notion that video game reviewers, who kind of, they're like the voice of the industry, you got this whole like battalion of people out there all kind of imitating the reviewers, all kind of running and chasing the reviewers, and you play a game in 4 days and you move on to the next thing.
You grab the next one and you say, oh, I got Little Big Planet early, I'm going to tell you what I thought about the first hour.
And people Twitter about it, so you get the Twitter. Absolutely. And then people are like, why, you're playing this? No way. And then they'll get on it.
I've been thinking about that mentality a lot as we've been getting into the fall. I mean, people do not, they don't appreciate what they're playing because they're already waiting for the next thing to come out.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't even finished talking about Far Cry and they're already talking about, you know, Gears of War 2 or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And no, I feel definitely it. Go ahead.
No. I feel it. I feel this compulsion. I mean, I'm in Fable 2. I'm really enjoying it a lot, but I'm not very far into it. And already I'm feeling this need to, you know, come on, step it up. Let's go, you know.
Get guilt.
Yeah, you're missing Far Cry 2. Everybody's Twittering about Far Cry 2. Don't forget Little Big Planet's coming. I got my Amazon thing. Fallout 3's on the way. You know, and I just love, like, exploring every little nook and cranny. It's a little crazy thing about the way I like to play adventure.
And the developers
games.
Meant you to. That's how it's meant to be played.
Oh,
it's not
yeah.
meant to be something that you bang through. They wouldn't want you to.
But you feel it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that is definitely what I wrote about, the guilt and the compulsion. You know, I love Pixel Junk Eden. That's one of my favorite games all year, and I play it just about every day. And every time I get done with my work day about 6 p.m., and I go straight to Pixel Junk Eden, and I always feel a little twinge of guilt because I'm looking at my games that are still in seal. I'm like, oh, shouldn't you be playing something else? I'm like, no, but I want to play this, you know. And I'm not really an objective consumer at all, like talking about keeping up with the reviewers. You know, I write. You know, my job is about 45 hours a week at Gamasutra, and then I'm doing, at any given time, I have more than one review and a column due, especially at month end. So, you know, like I'm devoting like 60 hours a week to thinking about games and writing about games. So, you know, I don't really even have the luxury to be out of the loop if I wanted to. So I definitely have the overwhelm for sure. You know, like if you're talking about chasing after the reviewers, we don't want to be leading the march. You know, we would like to stop and play a little bit too.
Yeah.
So I think for me, the reason that, you know, it hasn't been an intentional overlook of the big titles at all. I've wanted to, but I'm also observing probably a subconscious retreat. I think that the fact that I'm spending so much time playing really low engagement, lightweight games, I'm relying on DS a lot. I'm literally just sitting in bed and watching my Princess debut dances. Like, I really think that there's a desire, you know, there's an intellectual overload for me. There's an emotional overwhelm, and I am using games to relax and to escape rather than feeling ready to sink my teeth into something.
Yeah. Mitch, you write, I mean, would you say that you write sort of on deadline with reviews that you do?
Yeah, I generally get about a game a week. So it has been, you know, I never like to complain about any aspect of this because there's a million people who would kill to get paid.
Oh, absolutely. I'm definitely not complaining. But
it's really awful when I have to just discard a game I like after a week because the next game showed up.
Yeah.
And I have to just move right on, regardless of how I felt about the last game. You know, there's so many games that I have never completed or I almost got to it, and I have this pile of games that is someday I'll get back to this, except that there's always some new awesome thing that people need to know about and I need to start playing it today.
Yeah.
It's really tough sometimes. It's usually not a problem, but occasionally, especially, you know, this season, I the kinds of games I do like to play are these really big, you know, macho M-rated games that come out every fall. You know, I want to play all these things that are coming out, and I'm not going to. You know, I will never be able to catch up with all of them.
Yeah. I think that, too, one of the kind of sad aftermaths of all this is that you don't really get to contemplate a game. I mean, the two of you are writers who I think of as doing this occasionally, where you just take your own time to sort of stop and reflect on a game in a way that isn't like a review, but more, you know, really kind of just looking in between the spaces in the game and thinking about the game contextually. But I mean, this whole mentality just runs counter to the very notion of, you know, contemplating a game in even just a small part of a game that you want to focus on.
It's very hard to do that. It takes, yeah, I always want every review that I write to be like that, because I think you can go anywhere to get the review that says, oh, it looks really good, the play control is good, you know, get the quote-unquote objective review. It's not what I think people need. It's not what I want to write, but it's very hard to do unless you can really take the time to sink your teeth into a game and actually understand it as opposed to just sort of evaluate it.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to do with just the deadline process, just period. You know, a lot of times what you'll see are people who have had time. You know, if you see somebody just now who's playing Call of Duty 4, and I bring that up because Iroquois Pliskin, our good friend at Versus Clue Clue Land there, was just writing about Call of Duty 4. He wasn't on deadline. He had been playing it. It's a year old. And he wrote really interesting things about it that were probably more interesting than any of the real reviews that ran of it a year ago.
Yeah.
I used to have the luxury to do the same when all I really did was Sexy Video Game Land and I wasn't working, you know, full time like I am now. And, you know, also to an extent, one thing that's constantly on my mind is that I am absolutely not representative of the normative consumer. And the people who are listening to this podcast are probably not going to be representative of the average consumer. It's always such a wake up call when I go to a GameStop because, you know, like no one in line, like, has ever, you know, they don't read reviews. They don't often know what, say, like Kotaku is. And I introduce myself and they don't know my name and they don't know who I write for and they've never read a thing I've written and they don't, you know, they're just not in that world the way that all of us who are involved in the blogosphere, who have careers in game journalism or who read those things and seek them out or who want to discuss them on forums, they just don't do that. They're buying Madden, you know, they're there to buy one game. They haven't, you know, they have one or two games at home. They have, you know, Call of Duty, Halo, Madden, and they're there for, you know, one more and they want to know what's new and what's good. And so a lot of times when I'm writing reviews, I'm thinking about that person. Yeah. Because I almost think that the person who is going to be participating in this discussion with us is, you know, has their own critical perspective on games already. And they don't go to, say, to Sexy Video Game Land so much to learn about whether they should buy something or as they do to sort of share in the experience of being part of the space, you know, because, you know, they're already in it. They're already there in to such a large extent. So, you know, not only are Mitch and I on deadline when we're writing reviews, but we're also trying to make our review useful to the largest number of people, you know, because again, I bet, you know, people who are reading, you know, if they pick up the print edition of Variety or they're reading the Phoenix, they're not also then going to go to six different blogs that day and want to find out a really, really in-depth discussion on the symbolism of Silent Hill, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I spent the afternoon on a bus with a bunch of students today coming back from seeing a play in Indianapolis, and we were talking about games, and it struck me, I think about Fallout 3, which I'm really excited to get my hands on, as an October game. That's an October game. All of these guys think of it as a Christmas game.
Yeah.
Like they're coming out now, so they'll be ready for them to get as Christmas gifts.
Exactly.
That's the whole point. That's the regular consumer. We are not.
Yeah, by Christmas, we're going to be thinking about how Fallout 3 is an old game.
Totally. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
And even something like I wanted to get BioShock on the PS3. Like, I wanted to revisit BioShock because I haven't even thought about it in like 8 months. You know, and I'm constantly, if I like search in my search bar for my blog of BioShock, I mention it constantly, but I haven't played it in ages, and I would like to play it again and see what I think of it now and perhaps observe if it's different on the PS3, but I just don't have the time for that. And yet there are consumers walking into stores right now who have never heard of BioShock, and they're like, oh, what's this for my PlayStation, you know? It's really, there's a big schism, and you know, hopefully, you know, what we can do is try to maybe find a middle ground in the print writing that we do that sort of welcomes, you know, your casual consumer into a deeper way of appreciating the medium, but doesn't exclude, you know, that the writing doesn't exclude, you know, exclude anyone, you know, so that it satisfies both parties on the side of this crazy, crazy divide.
Right. And we make all kinds of crazy assumptions, too, about what people can afford. I mean, is regular... people can't buy all these games, every single one that comes out. It's a crazy thing.
And I end
it
up buying
me when I find out that people don't own every system.
I know.
You want to play everything. You don't have a choice in this, but one is enough for most people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that means they probably will not be able to play Little Big Planet at all because they wanted to play Gears, you know, and we're like, but that's the average person, you know, it really is. And actually, I do a lot of buying games because I'm not on everybody's list, and I don't try to be because I don't ask for games unless I actually have a print placement for it or have a need to review it, you know, like I don't just hit people up for freebies. You know, and I do get a lot. Like, I get a dazzling number of games, and then even still, I'm still buying them. And then I'm thinking of, like, oh, God, what is it like for the person who has a budget and they can't spend $200 a month? You know what I mean? Like, for me, it's an investment because it's my job. But the cost of games is actually, you know, pretty considerable. And that, you know, it's an interesting question whether to factor in the price of a game in your review. Like, the idea of value for money, and some people say you should and some people say you shouldn't, but you know, it often occurs to me now, like, God, what is it like for people who actually are just shelling out like normal people, you know what I mean?
I don't know, maybe we should talk about it more, because, and you know, with the economy like it is, that's probably even more of a factor.
I know we wanted to speak about survival horror, but now that I have both of you guys on the phone, I wanted to ask your thoughts on something. I feel really insulated from what is apparently a devastating economic crisis. Our industry is thriving. My job is fine. And I'm, you know, I've got boxes and boxes full of like $60 games that I just don't have the time to play, you know? And then when I finish working, I turn on the TV and there's like widespread panic on the global markets. And that's a strange schism for me. You know, I feel really insulated and strange that we're speaking on a Sunday night about how we're overwhelmed by how many games there are. And yet, like, we might be having an economic collapse. Like, does that seem strange to any of you guys?
Yeah, Mitch, well, you want to go first on that one?
It does. I mean, I don't follow the business side of things too much. In fact, one thing I was going to say quickly was I don't think reviewers should take price into account, although I think that they do on the big sites like IGN and stuff, and that's fine. But for the stuff we talk about, we're talking about games that whether they would exist, you know, a year from now, 10 years from now, what we say about it should still be true. My understanding is that this is supposedly one of those industries that is sort of recession-proof in the sense of it is a pretty good bargain that you can buy Fallout 3 for $60 and then play it for, you know, 100 hours, say. So that it is, you know, in that sense, it's a heck of a lot more cost-efficient than going on a vacation where you spend a couple thousand dollars for a week. So I certainly, I wouldn't expect that the games are going to dry up anytime soon, but it's a good question. I mean, nobody really knows where it's going to go. You never know what effects it's going to have.
Like I just feel strange, like, lamenting our bounty while, you know, other people are sort of worrying about if they're going to get to keep their jobs.
Yeah, it's in my business, you know, it's students wondering about whether their parents are going to be able, are going to have the jobs that they currently have. And I live in a place where there are a fair number of our students whose parents work in the automobile industry.
Oh my gosh! And yeah.
So it's high pressure times for us. And I have had to reconsider a number of things that I originally thought I would ask my students to do this year. I sort of made this deal with them where I would provide all the reading material they would need for this RPG course that I'm teaching, and I would expect them to use the money they would have spent on books to buy games. And you know, about halfway through the semester, I've decided I can't bring myself to have them go buy still more a bunch more games.
Video games in an economic crisis, but
yeah.
I probably shouldn't be recommending this out loud, but a lot of the games that you're interested in looking at can be torrented for emulators. They may not have to spend any money. Not that I'm condoning piracy, but
if it's for educational purposes,
it's fine.
There must be something. There's some law. It's fine. Don't worry.
Let's just say they solve the problems in a variety of ways.
So. You're teaching them to do a lot of things in life, a lot of life skills.
Yeah, if you want to be a gamer, you kind of have to learn about that. I don't know many people who haven't had their education in that. You know, they had their dabbling period and now they've went straight or whatever.
Well, the craziest thing is we played Fallout 1 and 2 and we used Good Old Games for that. And Good Old Games.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say.
Oh, it's fabulous. And they were so nice to me. They gave me, you know, licenses for the guys. And so it was really cool. And the guys got both games. And so I thought that what we really need to do is time this, and then when Fallout 3 comes out, we'll go right into that, right? So they'll be able to really think hard about how that series has evolved, and I know I'm going to get some really great papers and stuff. But a bunch of them don't have an Xbox 360 or a PS3.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, we're going to stick with the assignment, but, you know, I've asked them quite, to be honest with me, about how they're solving the problem. And, you know, in the case, I have three guys who are going together to buy one of the systems. I have another one where, you know, some guys live near another guy who's down the, you know, hall, and they've talked him into letting them have the PS3 from 7 to 9 p.m. You know, I mean, they're solving the problem.
Have them all over at your house?
Yeah, well, that could happen. That could happen. I've already convinced the administration to let me buy a 360 for my office because all my stuff's at home. And so people can come in here and play here in my office.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, it's, you know, you solve these problems. But I mean, just to say, hey, let's play some games and, you know, let's play some of these more contemporary games. It's not a very easy problem to solve. And especially when these guys are worried about whether they're going to have their tuition money. So, well, you mentioned a minute ago that we said we wanted to talk about survival horror, and that's where I want to segue now. And part of the reason that I invited the two of you in particular, you old high school mates, you, I didn't mention, but you both went to the same high school.
We did.
Yes. And you both have written really interesting pieces recently about the survival horror genre related to the release of Dead Space, which, Mitch, you have, your review is up for that, the Phoenix. I'll link to that on my site. And, Lee, you wrote also about the new Silent Hill game. You've written a couple of pieces,
yep,
about that. So I really thought it would be interesting to just kind of do a kind of a diagnostic check on the survival horror genre from your point of view. With the release of these two games, what is the status of that genre and how is it changing? How do you think it's going to continue to change? And is it still alive and kicking, maybe, is a place to start?
It's undead and kicking.
That's probably a better way of putting it.
Well, it's pretty interesting, I think, to compare these two games because Dead Space is sort of maybe the next step in the genre, except it turns out not to feel very much like survival horror at all, whereas the new Silent Hill game is, to my mind, almost identical to past Silent Hill games. It's almost like they went back and said, we need to make sure that this new Silent Hill game has everything the old ones had. It doesn't really try to push on. And they're both successful in their own ways, and they both missed the mark in a couple of ways. But the interesting thing I would say about Dead Space is it strikes me really not as survival horror at all. It really struck me as a shooter with horror elements. If I don't know, Lee, if you think that's too fine a distinction, I'm not sure.
Well, to be fair, I haven't fully played it yet. I have demoed it during E3, so I'm familiar with it. I have not played it all the way through, so whatever perspective I can offer on Dead Space will be from a limited perspective. But last month, I did write a pretty extensive feature noting Dead Space against Silent Hill before either of them were released, even though, again, limited exposure to either of them prior to release. But to me, there's a couple of issues going on, and I think that it's sort of fitting that the discussion is taking place around these two games, because to my mind, it really breaks down to a clear difference between the way the Japanese have always designed horror and the way the West considers horror. And the second, I guess, concept that I'm trying to get my head around is that survival horror as a genre in broader media, you know, if we're talking films or, you know, just horror in general, films, books, television, is really cliche prone. And it actually, you know, you could argue that it even thrives on cliches, that it's scary because it's formulaic. And I think that the game industry is at a point right now where it's prepared to or attempting to innovate a lot more than it's given credit for. So we're sort of torn at this point between Eastern sensibilities and Western sensibilities. And we're torn at this point between innovating and, you know, one of the most cliched standby formats in entertainment media that we've had for years. So there's I think, a couple fundamental conflicts that are going around when we look at both of these games. I do agree with Mitch. The feature that I wrote for Kotaku last month was analyzing, you know, what does survival horror mean to us as gamers? You know, where did it originate? Where did we get these ideas? And, you know, what extenuating industry factors are sort of influencing the genre and moving forward? I think one of them is that Japanese development, as far as having prominence or leadership, is a bit on decline in favor of the West, which is sort of, you know, to some people's perceptions, started to grow past Japan a little bit in several key areas. So as we're seeing West dominate, we're seeing Western sensibilities for horror dominate. And so we're seeing a very technical approach to horror. We're seeing this strategic dismemberment and this, as Mitch says, shooter with horror elements. Whereas, you know, we may have in the past been accustomed to, you know, our old school, not the new Resident Evil, but old school Resident Evils and our Silent Hills, which sort of bears the mark of an Eastern sensibility that prefers asking questions and not answering them, whereas in the West we like to have everything sort of action reaction and very clearly resolved. Yeah, so that's my diatribe on that. But yeah, it's a complicated thing, definitely.
Do you find that, I mean, this seems like a silly question, but do they produce horror anymore? I mean, do survival horror games produce horror in the player?
It sort of depends on how you define horror. To me, the most scary video game that there is the Fatal Frame series, which is not gruesome or horrific at all. It's creepy. You know, your weapon is a camera. You're attacking ghosts with photographs, and the ghosts are associated with things like spirit and memory and religion, which are things that the Japanese have sort of based fright around, whereas in the West, we're much more acclimated to murder and psychopathy and gore as being elements of horror. And you know, obviously some people prefer the former approach and some people prefer the latter approach. We're familiar enough with the format of both Eastern and Western horror that perhaps it isn't frightening anymore because we've developed such a systematic approach to it.
Yeah, I would say that it probably depends almost entirely on, you know, the subjectivity of a person playing. I've talked to a lot of people who have said that they think Dead Space is the scariest game they've ever played, or the scariest game since, I don't know, somebody said since System Shock 2, which I thought was just mind-blowing, because I thought Silent Hill Homecoming was far scarier than Dead Space.
Ditto.
The reason being is that Dead Space it's almost entirely surface. You know, it's very gory. You know, there's body parts everywhere. There's monsters jumping out at you. It's loud, but it's all right there on the surface. They really don't do a lot of slow burns. They don't do build-ups to things. There's not a lot of lurking horror. It's here's the gore right in your face, and that is not as scary to me as something like Silent Hill, where, you know, you're not even really sure if anything in the game is real. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not sure, is this happening in somebody's head? Is this a nightmare? Is it a hallucination?
When you finish the game, you don't really know. It really depends on what ending you get and how you beat the game and what your interpretation of it is. And that's another... Right. And
they just don't resolve it at all. And even during the game, when it's, you could say that it's very obvious that there are physical threats to the character. You know, he really is dying when you die. But the way they choose to approach this is by keeping the creatures off screen most of the time. There are times when you're walking down the street in the fog and you hear a monster, but you're not sure if it's there.
Right.
And that to me is so much scarier than Dead Space, which really was things jumping out at you over and over and over. It was like being in you know, a charity haunted house or something where kids just jump out at you shrieking.
And the game is designed with that. I mean, places exist in the game in order for there to be monsters there.
Like
that's the whole reason why that room's there or this door's there or whatever. It's so that the monster can be jumping out at you or you can be jumping into
it. They did an okay, like a better than average job in Dead Space of making the ship seem like it really was a ship, you know, where they really were doing work and things like that. But yeah, you still got the impression like nobody actually lived here. This was never a vibrant community. This is just, you know, it is a haunted house.
Yeah.
And by contrast, you had, I mean, for me, some of the most, you know, and I don't think this is spoilers, some of the most powerful, you know, because the game is called Homecoming, some of the most powerful scenes in Silent Hill is when you're at the protagonist's house, because you can extrapolate a sentiment associated with the place. And to me, that worked for Bioshock, and it worked for Fatal Frame, and it worked for Rule of Rose, and all the other games that I sort of respect as far as that genre goes.
It's interesting.
There was sadness in Silent Hill. You know, there were other things besides frights in that game, and that's what made it more resonant.
Yeah, the truly poignant things were not, as Mitch says, surface, you know, objects or enemies or things coming at you.
Right. There's a whole psychological dimension to them. And I think that carries through into combat in the sense that, and I'd originally invited Duncan Fife on, and we'll have him on another time. He was going to join us, and I think he's in New Zealand, so who knows what could have happened. It's tomorrow for him there. But I wanted to work this in because it intrigued me. You know, he has a take on this, which he's written about recently, which has to do with the idea that a real survival horror experience is a very pared down one, so that it unlike the kind of the evolution of games, which seem to be heading towards choice and consequences of choice and multiple choices that enable you to not only choose which weapon, but choose which strategy and choose, you know, from any number of menu options in terms of how you want to create your character or how you deal with your inventory. And survival horror is you and a knife and a room and you've got to get out, you know?
Yeah.
And that when you pare that down, which in some ways Dead Space doesn't do, in Dead Space as a shooter, as you're saying, Mitch, there are options to do X number of things. The more it's pared down, and in certain ways, the more awkward it is in terms of control. If it doesn't, in fact, control like a dream, but if in fact it's a little awkward and a little difficult, that somehow that adds to the dimension of desperation.
It feels like such a cheap argument to make that.
I have to wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I also agree that it was scarier in Silent Hill 2 because the combat sucked so bad. But as I have said a million times, it was not on purpose. It was a happy accident that we learned to live with. You know, I definitely think it's a cop out when you say, "Oh, the combat's supposed to be bad, and this game isn't scary because it's designed too well." You know, that doesn't quite work.
But if you maybe a better way of arguing it would be to say it's about the question of like targeting, that it the more you enable the player to, you know, really pinpoint and really control targeting in very specific kind of shooter-esque ways, the less it feels like you with few resources, you know, kind of stuck with this creature or whatever it is, a dog or whatever you're fighting, that it maybe it's just the simplicity of the situation in survival horror games that I sort of yearn for.
You do want to feel vulnerable, certainly.
Yeah, definitely.
And that is something Dead Space didn't really do. I mean, granted, I played it on normal difficulty, so I think I had more resources at my disposal. I think it was a little bit easier. But you could apply the skills that you had learned from something like Halo to Dead Space and make your way through it pretty well. Whereas something like Silent Hill, it was very easy to die. I mean, your character, he's a guy who was in the military, and he's not really very good at fighting. You know, he's as vulnerable as anybody would be if monsters actually came crawling around. So there is something to that. There's something to making you really in peril. But it's a weird thing to say that it's good because it's so hard to make your character do what you want him to do.
Yeah. Right. I mean, choice and resources are ammunition the same way that weapons and muscles and all of those other strength items would be considered ammunition. And I definitely don't think that what we take away from this is that survival horror games need to have everyman combat, because, I mean, I like that, but I don't think it's necessarily true. I just think that if you have a player who's a competent combatant, then you need to take control away from the player in other ways. And Silent Hill does that by having environmental elements placed at just about every interval that make you question the reality of where you are as a character, question your sanity and your stability. You know, by making you doubt, you know, Rule of Rose is probably your quintessential terrible, awesome game. I mean, it is terrible as a game, but as a story and as a horror experience and as an environmental experience, it remains one of my favorite games of all time. And that's in part because the environment was so dreamlike, so questionable, and such a suspension of any logical law that you were always afraid because you couldn't even trust where you were. Mm-hmm. So I think that when you have a game, you know, like Dead Space, or even like Silent Hill 5, where the combat is much more competent than it has previously been. I'm not necessarily saying that you have to have a vulnerable hero or a poor combatant, but find a way to violate the player through the environment, through the story, some other way, because having complete control and being completely powerful will never be frightening.
Well, I'll say that actually made me just think of something. I'm on record, I think, in several places as saying I think Resident Evil 4 is the best game I've ever played. And in a lot of ways, I'm not the first person to say that I think Dead Space was trying to be a lot like Resident Evil 4. But I never really thought of this before. The combat was really good there, you know, and it really was about shooting them in the leg to make them drop down. But the fact that the fact that it rooted you to the spot if you wanted to shoot made you always have to trade off. Do I want to stop and shoot? Do I want to run? I can't do both.
Hmm. Right.
You know, with Dead Space, again, you could strafe around. You know, you could have your gun ready when you walked around the corner, and you know, you could be ready for it. And Resident Evil 4 said you have to choose one or the other because you can't do both.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was told about Dead Space, and Mitch, you can probably verify, is that they had disabled your ability to sort of halt the action and reload through your pause menu. Like, you couldn't stop. Like, with Resident Evil 4, if you wanted to re-equip something or you ran out of inventory, you jam that pause button real fast, you get your little case up real quick, and you can shuffle your items around, you can get a nice little lull in the action, you can use your herbs, but it doesn't work that way in Dead Space, right?
It was actually one of the best things they did in that game. There is a pause. You can hit the start button and you'll get up the little menu, but you can't do anything to affect the game in the pause menu.
Right.
Everything that would ordinarily halt a game, like your map and your inventory and your mission objectives, is actually projected within the game world in front of your character.
Hmm.
So you could be watching a video log of, you know, so you pick one up, you get filled in on the story, but at that moment, a monster jumps out at you as the video log is still playing. And it
so
was
you still have a vulnerability.
Yeah, that is the thing they did better than anybody else probably has ever done, is really ground it in this physical reality. And it's true that you aren't really safe when you're looking through your map or anything. And that's something I would like to see a lot more games do, because a lot of them don't do it. You don't have those kind of meta-textual elements in Dead Space.
Usually when a genre gets very fixed in our minds and it becomes so formulaic that everyone knows all the rules backwards and forwards, that's the time when you start to deconstruct it. And, you know, I remember the first time I played Eternal Darkness and, you know, this sort of crazy things that the game would do to you to sort of mess with you. And I thought, okay, we're now in for a whole, you know, slew of imitators of that sort of, you know, experience where they play with you, they play with the game and sort of in ways that Kojima plays around with. And actually, it didn't really happen. I mean, it would seem to me that survival horror would be the genre where you could really start to mess with the player's experience and the way that you relate to the actual game itself and the hardware and your controller and all kinds of stuff. And nobody really seems to want to go there.
Yeah, it's very, very challenging, I think, to do what you're talking about is a breach of the fourth wall, which, you know, has been applied successfully, often for humor or for side effect or for Easter egg in a lot of games. But as you say, very rarely to a point where it can actually, you know, even Kojima does it largely for humor with like the Psycho Mantis stuff.
Right.
But I didn't play Eternal Darkness, but I also think that it is very challenging to design that in a way that it will genuinely surprise and affect the player instead of making the player go, oh, hey, I'm playing a video game. You know, you're reminding me that I'm playing a video game.
Yeah.
I think that the objective for a lot of designers of survival horror is to create, you know, their tactic for engendering fear is to create that absolute immersion so that the line for you between the game and reality becomes indistinct. But they do that not by making the game seem real, but by I think both Dead Space and Silent Hill and similar, you know, modern horror games, even Resident Evil, are very immersive, to the point where, you know, if you shut off your lights, you're not going to be focusing on anything else. And then when you are finished playing and you walk away, you take the environment with you. So they are trying to draw you in rather than bring the game out. Because, again, I think that the reason for the hesitation you see is that people have made immersion such a priority that they're terrified to break it. And
yeah.
To some extent, I feel that it's so challenging to do it well that I'm glad that not too many people are trying to play with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but when they do it well, it's totally worth it. I mean, there's kind of a middle ground, I think, between, because generally I would say that I do not want to be reminded when I'm playing a video game that it's not real. I want to lose myself in it. But there
right.
were a couple games last year that kept me immersed like that, but still played with my expectations. And those games were The Darkness and BioShock.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know the BioShock twist. But can I talk about it? It's been a year.
I think we can talk about that.
They say, you know, yeah. they basically play with your built-in assumption that it's a good idea to follow whatever instructions you start receiving.
Right.
When you play a video game, they don't do it by making you think, haha, you were just playing a video game. But the story makes that twist that would never be so potent if you hadn't already played a ton of video games in your life. And The Darkness is something similar, you know, where you would be in control most of the time, and then suddenly you'd be enjoying your darkness powers, you'd be using this demon to help you kill everybody, and then suddenly the demon takes control of you, and you suddenly the control pad's not working anymore, and really bad things are happening to you. You know, that really worked. It wasn't like telegraphing that you're playing a game, but they took your expectations and just twisted them ever so slightly.
Mm-hmm.
I played another game like that. One of the other survival horror mainstays that I'm a big fan of is Haunting Ground. And it played with a sort of panic mechanic where, you know, your character was incapable of fighting at all. You pretty much had to stick your dog on people or hide. And the game world was sort of built up so that you could run and hide very well. And to me, you know, Haunting Ground is one of the most frightening games I've ever played because it was entirely running and hiding. Like, that's the stuff of nightmares. I don't know about you guys, but when I have scary dreams, I'm not fighting, I'm running, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing that it did was if you had encountered or come near to an enemy during pursuit too many times, your character, you know, you'd start to have visual and audio feedback that was very, very similar, I gather, to what people experience when they get a panic attack. Like, the sound would get cottony and you would hear your own heart, and you would then become unable to control the character well, and your visual feedback would be messed up, and you could not run efficiently, and you would kind of be stumbling around and falling a lot, you know, which heightened the fear because you as a player had become incapacitated because your character became frightened. So that's another thing that's a lot like how you're talking about. But in situations like these, I think the game designers are conscious of not penalizing the player, because, you know, if you're making the wrong decisions, if you are quote unquote playing badly, if you're getting attacked a lot or if you're being injured a lot, for the game to incapacitate you or to mess with you would only sort of penalize you for doing poorly to the point where you couldn't recoup. So I think that implements an interesting design conundrum for them when they're looking at, you know, if the penalty for poor performance makes it even harder to perform well, that's frustrating, you know, beyond the point where I think a lot of people would want to play it.
Yeah, it has to feel like it's not necessarily so much a penalty, but a consequence of some crazy thing. They do that even like in with No More Heroes, where they make the controls backwards. So, you know, if you push up and you're going backwards, you push back and you go forward.
Oh, I love that upside down level because I hang upside down off the couch. And this is honestly No More Heroes. When it comes time for me to start picking my games of the year, I'm gonna have to start thinking hard about No More Heroes, and I swear at least 15% of the reason is because I was able to play a game hanging upside down off of my couch, and it was just so it was so delightful. I would play, you know, that level also you gain a lot of money from playing the upside down subway level, and so I would just play it over and over hanging upside down because I was like, how different, how fun, you know. I just thought that was awesome.
And that to me, that's sort of scratching at it a little bit of what I'm hoping that designers will continue to think about with survival horror, that it can, you don't necessarily have to tear down the fourth wall, but games are so reliant on these set of mechanics that we just don't ever think about, and that they're so standardized, that just a little bit more playfulness about that, and just maybe a little bit of peeking around the fourth wall occasionally, or just knocking at it a little bit, I would be up for that. I mean, maybe the argument that there's plenty of life in this old horse is that the cinema really, you could argue that the cinema has basically run out of survival horror ideas to the extent that now you lampoon it. That actually the
Saw 5
totally the most successful horror films these days are horror lampoons or like commentaries on horror or whatever, that there's this meta thing going on. Oop, you there? Hello?
I'm still here.
Oop. Are you there, Lee?
I think we lost Lee. It said call dropped.
Oh, okay. Let me see if I can grab her back.
Oh, we'll have to edit this part out.
No, boy.
Now leave this part. It'll be fine. Nobody will notice. We're breaking the fourth wall of the podcast.
See, this is actually...
We don't know what happened to Lee.
You were looking at her funny, Mitch. I'm worried about what happened to Lee.
I hope this is not Lee's blood.
Well,
leave that part. Leave that part in the podcast.
Okay.
People will love that.
All right. I'm ringing her up again.
Sorry about that. I got kicked out.
Hey, that's okay. Hold on a second.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, okay, here we go.
I think I have to remake the conference call, so I'm going to hang up and I'll reconnect us.
All right, cool. Hello?
Hey, you guys back?
Hey.
Okay.
We sure are.
See, when we were talking about the fourth wall, you suddenly disappeared, and Mitch, started to frighten me a little, and we started to think that something bad had happened.
No, I definitely had something to add as far as what you were saying. You were saying that you... No, I have to complete this thought. You were saying that you wanted to see game development start to play around a little bit more and experiment with the fourth wall and try new things. And for me, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about a struggling with a line between really wanting to innovate and dealing with a genre that's very cliched. And we also have a review culture and a consumer culture that, if you look at the pattern, penalizes innovation. For them, it's a business, and when they're taking something to their, to their publisher or to their executive review board, and they say, hey, we want to do something really different, the guys who make the money happen are going to go, no, because the last guys who tried to do something different got a Metacritic score of 50, and so why don't you just make the same game that they did? You know what I mean?
Right, right. And Dead Space, I'm guessing that it's going to do very well.
For sure.
And it'll be a franchise and, all that. I'm curious, Mitch, just so that we can kind of round this off on Dead Space, because we've mentioned a few things about it. To what degree are the production values of that game? A lot of people are talking about the sound and the really incredible environments and stuff. To what degree are those things responsible for the way that game, the good ways in which that game works?
I mean, it's almost all of it. It's a really, really well-polished, kind of well-balanced shooter. I mean, by the objective metrics that most reviewers use, it aces all of those. I mean, it looks great. It sounds amazing. The control is phenomenal. I mean, it's very easy to get that wrong in a third-person shooter, and they didn't do it. And I think that is actually most of what people are reacting to, is that here is this very good shooter that they then are... sort of saying, oh, well, this is great horror game too, even though it's not that so much, because they focused mostly on the mechanics of the game.
Yeah.
It's a really good video game. It's not the best horror experience that I've ever played.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's those tight mechanics and that watertight design that garners, consumer acclaim and that gets good Metacritic scores. So I think we're going to continue to ultimately see tight design be the presiding factor.
You should always try for that. Sure, no matter what you do. And I'm sort of surprised that people are talking about Dead Space as, you know, this is the new EA. They innovated here, because this is a game that as you play it, you can just tick off the influences one after another. And for as well done as it is, it's certainly not, you know, a flash of genius. It's more like it was. Yeah, it's like a focus group kind of a thing where what are these great games that have been made before? Let's do everything they did. Let's make sure we do nothing different than that, which is good, which is, you know, what I said in my review. Basically, it's good. It's not great.
For EA, too, their mandate was sort of to improve the quality. And I think for them, it would be a success that what you're highlighting is the tightness of the tautness and the good performance of the game design, you know, because they sort of needed that in their stable for quite some time. So I think when people are saying the new EA, that's what they're reacting to. But I think a lot of people are not understanding how to pick out, you know, the difference between something that's really high quality and something that's really high innovation, because quality itself is rather inconsistent in games. So when people just see something that works really well, they're like, hey, this is new and different, even though, you know, it may not necessarily be new and different.
I can't remember the podcast I was listening to, but it was a podcast, one of the big, you know, IGN or one of podcasts, where the guys were saying, well, you know, I really liked it as Dead Space, but if it had been System Shock 3, I would have hated it.
That's funny.
Yeah, I could see that, because it doesn't really push past that at all. And it doesn't just System Shock had this level of subtext to it that Dead Space doesn't really have the imagination for. I mean, even though they're extremely similar, I was just actually thinking about this before the podcast. Both System Shock 2 and Dead Space have the inhabitants of the ship are sort of taken over by this malevolent life form and sent to attack you. In Dead Space, that's all it is. It's these gross monsters. In System Shock 2, they still retained this level of humanity where they knew what they were doing and they were horrified. So the monsters are coming at you and they are asking for your forgiveness and they are begging you to kill them. And it's just this horror. That is horror right there. It's not this gross, icky monster. It's this gross, icky monster that is human somewhere in there.
Absolutely.
And that's what they didn't, that's the kind of thing they didn't think about in Dead Space,
I wish I could tell you guys this rumor that I heard, but I can't. I have to protect the person. It's not a rumor, but I have to protect the person who told it to me. But I just think it's funny that you said, oh, if Dead Space had been System Shock 3, that's all I can say on that. But yeah.
Well,
I wonder about the roots of that game. But yeah. If you just to come back to Silent Hill real quick, that remark, though, that if it had been System Shock 3, I would have hated it. But since it's Dead Space, I like it. That's a fascinating remark to me, in the sense that, because Silent Hill is Silent Hill and you iterate on that, by the time you get to 4, 5, whatever number you get to, you call it Homecoming, whatever you're going to do, you invite this kind of nitpicking, you know, this kind of, well, where's the new stuff? How's it different? How are you going to make this more interesting?
And yet, if they had made it different, it would not have done well either.
Bingo. That's the conundrum that I'm interested in. Sort of where, if I wouldn't want to go anywhere near that franchise. If they paid me all kinds of money, and if I knew how to be a game designer, I would say, sorry, give me another game. I don't want to touch that franchise.
I mean, Double Helix had such a steep mandate from this very, very hardcore, long running fan base. And part of the reason that I feel so good about the game is that, oh my goodness, there are so many difficult, intangible Silent Hill things that they nailed, and not only did they do it, but they did it differently. They did not just rehash the memes of Silent Hill 2, for example. They kept the spirit of Silent Hill while still creating a new story, which I thought was extremely challenging, especially for an American studio, given that most of these games are largely Japanese-designed games and are influenced by, you know, sort of the society of Japanese design and the Japanese mores about horror and about designing for horror. So that they were able to even like make it so that every toilet had a commentary, you know, like they just were so observant of all the things that make Silent Hill, Silent Hill. And again, this is another discussion. You know, we mentioned the price issue, but when reviewing a game, should reviewers take it into context as a franchise heir and not just as a standalone? I tend to lean toward that they should, because again, as Mitch said, like, if Silent Hill 5 had not been a Silent Hill game, that would have had to have stood against it. And you know, maybe that's wrong, but I can't justify it any other way, because Silent Hill fans are expecting Silent Hill.
Yeah.
And they did it. And I was so impressed with that because, like everyone else, I was so dubious. And I just...
The temptation to sex that game up and put a bunch of guns in it must have been overwhelming, but they didn't do it.
Overwhelming. No, they didn't do it. And they caught the subtext. And not only did they catch the subtext, but it's a fashion of designing for subtext that is not innate to Western design. And the fact that they were able to emulate it so well, I mean, you could knock them for being derivative. You could knock them for emulating previous games, but in this case, that was exactly what they were being asked to do. Yeah. That's exactly what fans of the series wanted them to do, and they pulled it off. And if people, you know, are going to critique them for not revamping Silent Hill, I don't know what they want, because a Silent Hill that didn't look like its predecessors would have been excoriated too. Look at 4; it's like the bastard stepchild of the series because it's different, you know.
Yeah. But if you stick to that, you keep that fan base, that very loyal fan base, happy, but you also limit the potential, you know, the broadening the appeal of the game.
And maybe that's okay. You know, not everyone likes John Grisham novels, but they don't want John Grisham to start writing, you know, supernatural fantasy. You know what I mean? Games are getting to be a large enough medium now where I think that we can have franchises that are intended to appeal to a fan base and some things that are new and different and meant to have general appeal. And, you know, when you just, I try to compare it to when you go to the library. There are some things that are repetitive serial romance novels that no one in their right mind are going to read. And yet there's a line of people who want to check out a V.C. Andrews novel that is exactly like the last one they just read. And they, you know, God bless them. That's what they want. They should be able to have it. You know, they shouldn't have to lose their V.C. Andrews serial novel just because it's not new, you know?
And I don't disagree with anything you've said, but that is not how reviewers approach these games.
Well, it's how I've been starting to approach them, I think, because games are too large for us to claim anymore that there is one standard that can be applied to every game and every franchise and every school of thought. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because there's so many different games and there's so many different audiences.
Yeah. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. And, you know, obviously we could continue it in all kinds of different directions. We sort of opened the door to the Japanese versus Western game design and horror genre as well. That would be an interesting road, and, you know, at least 3 or 4 others that we identified. Yeah. But I'm very grateful for your time and for your willingness to talk with me about your games of the month and this fascinating conversation about survival horror. Really terrific.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. And Mitch, you can go watch the World Series now.
Oh, excellent. Go Phillies, right? I guess.
Yeah, sure. I'll root for the Phillies.
Yeah. I got to root against Tampa.
I think I already said that I was rooting for Tampa, but honestly, I don't care. It's not the Yankees.
National League. Just root for the National League, whatever the team is.
There you go.
Well, thanks again, both of you, and best of luck to you. And I want to encourage everyone to read Sexy Video Game Land and read Insult Sword Fighting, two of the very best gaming blogs on the internet.
Mitch's is better.
Oh, you too. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
It was so nice to be on here with both of you. I really appreciate the work that both of you do, and I love your blogs. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Good night, guys.
Okay, good night. So that's the podcast, everybody. Thanks very much for listening. Get out there and play some games. You've got a few to choose from. As I said earlier, thank you very much for your feedback. Keep it coming. I'm always happy to hear from you with suggestions and praise and condemnations and whatever else you want to send my way. Happy gaming, everybody, and I'll probably be back sooner than a month because there's just so much stuff going on that I think it'd be fun to bring the Gamers Confab group together in a different configuration with different guests and take a look at some of these games and talk about them. And, you know, we're also getting near end of the year, so I'm sure we'll do some kind of best games of 2008. You know, a little cliche, I suppose, but I think they're fun. I enjoy that. So we'll probably do a special edition of the Gamers Confab on the podcast where we'll just sort of round them up and make our recommendations. So again, thanks for listening. See you next time.